Welcome to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Thank God it's Friday!
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
We will make America great again.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS to speak your mind. Now, First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
It's a very unusual situation to have opposition research like that, especially one that on its face had a number of clear mistakes and a somewhat jejune analysis, and to use that to conduct counterintelligence against an American political campaign is a strange would be a strange development.
And that is Attorney General William Barr talking about the very fact that is probably the reason an awful lot of Democrats are beside themselves with the fact that Barr is going to be investigating the investigation. He's going to find out why it was that the Bob Mueller investigation happened at all, what exactly sparked it. And if you think that's an obscure little academic point, understand what he's saying. And it's something we've talked about on this show over the last 2 years as we've watched Bob Mueller spend about $35 million of the American taxpayers' money doing an investigation that it now seems clear Bob Mueller himself knew was unwarranted within about the first 6 months of the investigation. But the Democrats wanted it. And why? Because they were convinced that Bob Mueller would find obstruction by President Trump. And he didn't. They were convinced that Bob Mueller would find that Donald Trump was connected somehow to the hacking of emails at the Democrat National Committee. And Bob Mueller did not. And they were convinced that Bob Mueller would find that there was collusion, not a crime, so let's call it conspiracy, which is what it was, an allegation that President Trump engaged in a conspiracy with Vladimir Putin and the Russians to affect the outcome of the 2016 election. And one more time, you're 0 for 3. Bob Mueller found that none of the things the Democrats said were true. The ones that folks like Adam Schiff, member of Congress, he said he had undeniable proof that this had actually happened. Well, since the Bob Mueller investigation didn't find it, a lot of us have been asking Adam Schiff, hey, Congressman, if you've got information that Bob Mueller didn't find using $35 million, almost 2 years of investigation, a whole team of lawyers, and he couldn't find it. He couldn't find it when he served 500 search warrants. He couldn't find it when he issued 2,700 subpoenas. He couldn't find it in the hundreds of thousands of pages of documents. He couldn't find it in any of those places, but somehow Adam Schiff from California had found the proof positive that Donald Trump was in fact a corrupt president. Well, if you've got it, Adam Schiff, you know, put up or shut up as far as I'm concerned. And now AG Barr is looking into where this all began. And I think what he's going to find is this. He's going to find that the entire investigation was driven by a Department of Justice and an FBI, not at the bottom ranks, but at the top ranks, that was thoroughly corrupt. And we even know the names of the corrupt figures, people like James Comey, people like Andrew McCabe, people like Peter Strzok, and people like Lisa Page, not to mention Bruce Ohr. And Bruce Ohr is probably one of the most interesting parts of all of this because Bruce Ohr is married to a woman who works for the company Fusion GPS that was hired by the Hillary Clinton presidential campaign to dig dirt on President Trump, then candidate Donald Trump. And they worked together with the DNC and paid a lot of money. The estimate is $16 million to dig as much dirt as they possibly could on Donald Trump. And they couldn't find enough legitimate, real dirt, so they hired a former British secret agent, Christopher Steele, and they said, if we give you a pile of money, do you think you can come up with some dirt? And do you know what he did? He went to his Russian contacts in the Russian government, and they said, oh, we've got all kinds of things for you. If you pay us enough money, why, we'd be glad to come up with any story you want. And they came up with a bunch of cockamamie stories, stories that Donald Trump had hired prostitutes to urinate on a bed that had once been occupied by Barack and Michelle Obama. I mean, crazy stuff like that. And they took the Steele dossier and they tried to shop it around to all the television networks prior to the election. And that didn't do any good because the television networks, even the television networks that seem to love anything that is salacious, I mean, they'll bite on almost anything. They looked at that and said, boy, without some corroboration, we're not touching that with a 10-foot pole. So then they took it to the DOJ. And the DOJ took it to a federal judge and presented it as though it had been carved on stone tablets and brought down from the burning bush on the top of a mountain. And they said, judge, this shows that there is some kind of bad stuff going on between Russia and candidate Donald Trump. And we'd like to start wiretapping some people, people like Carter Page. I mean, this is the story that we all know so very, very well. And what I've been telling you from the beginning is that we know where there was a conspiracy between an American actor by the name of Hillary Clinton. By actor, I'm using that in the generic sense. She is a person in America who wanted to be president. And she decided that if you cheat enough that your opponent, Bernie Sanders, can't even get the nomination, if you cheat by maintaining a secret email server, if you cheat by erasing government documents in violation of the law, if you cheat by treating classified documents as though they're, you know, a magazine you picked up at the corner convenience store, if you cheat enough, you can become president of the United States. And we also know that there were actors within the FBI, like Strzok and Page, who were scared to death that this information was going to get out. They needed, as they put it, an insurance policy to make sure that Donald Trump was never elected, because they could get away with all kinds of things as long as they knew that Hillary Clinton would be the president. Why? Because if Hillary was the president, none of us would know any of what we know today, that there was no collusion with Trump. There was no obstruction by Trump. There was no hacking by Trump. None of that. But what we do know is there was cheating by the Hillary Clinton campaign and by the DNC. In fact, the cheating within the DNC, which was only revealed because of WikiLeaks releasing those emails from the DNC, it was so bad that there were people who were ousted from the leadership of the DNC. Remember Debbie Wasserman Schultz? Ousted from the leadership because of all the cheating that was going on within the party. And we know that Hillary Clinton had gone to the party early on when she wanted to be the candidate. And she said, you got money troubles and I've got money. And I have troubles because I want to be the nominee. So let's put our heads together. I will solve your money problems if you make sure that I'm the nominee. And more cheating went on. Bernie Sanders, and this is something Democrats, I know some of you are Democrats, about a third of my audience is self-described liberal progressives. I know that there are people out there who ought to be angry that the candidate they favored, Bernie Sanders, not my favorite candidate, but he was the favorite of a lot of Americans, tens of millions of Americans who sent him money, who voted for him, who wanted him as the nominee, that opportunity was taken away by cheating, not by Donald Trump and Russia, but by Hillary Clinton and Russia and Christopher Steele and the DNC and also the FBI and the Department of Justice, and likely folks like Mr. Clapper at the National Security Agency. All of that, Director of National Security, National Intelligence, I should say, DNI. So all of that cheating was going on. And Americans should be scared to death of this kind of thing happening to our country. Because if ever, whether it's Republican or Democrat, the party in power can use the power of being the party in power to make sure that its side always stays in power, then democracy and representative government in this country is simply over. It's First Amendment Friday. Glad to have you with me. And every topic is fair game on First Amendment Fridays. And of course, naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. When we come back, we'll talk about manufacturing, a bedrock export for America. But are we pushing cars and trucks at the cost of corn and pigs? Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is a First Amendment Friday. Your calls are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Our Twitter poll today, should a diversity score from growing up poor boost your college SAT numbers? I would answer that no, but now apparently the Scholastic Aptitude Test Company is going to add a diversity score. So if you grew up in a poor neighborhood, or if you had poor parents, or if you had some other things that are seen as obstacles to your being educated, they're going to add an extra score and enhance your college SAT scores. It's the most phony baloney thing I've ever heard of. But the aim is apparently to try to allow institutions of higher education to engage in racism, to give extra points to people, but they can't use race. So they have to find other criteria that they can measure, which will tilt in the direction of giving an edge to some of the kids, mostly black kids and Hispanic kids, to give them an extra edge on those SAT scores without actually saying we're doing it about race. It's sneaky, it's conniving, and it's wrong. You can vote in it at Lars Larson Show on Twitter or LarsLarson.com on the web. I mentioned manufacturing as a bedrock for America. Some of the biggest exports we have are Boeing airplanes and Caterpillar tractors and cars and trucks and things like that. Lee Speakerman joins me now from Speakerman Media. Lee, good to have you back on a First Amendment Friday.
Great to be on, Lars.
So you're concerned about the fact that perhaps in deciding which kinds of trade we get concerned about and whether or not we're being treated equitably overseas, that we don't put as much attention, perhaps, on manufacturing as we do on agriculture. Can you give my audience an idea of your perspective on where we ought to be putting the focus?
Well, we definitely should be focused on manufacturing, and this farm export alarm is ridiculous. As I pointed out on Twitter today, we have in this country a $215 billion trade deficit just on auto vehicles, parts, and engines. $215 billion. Of that, $130 billion is just cars. In other words, we import $130 billion more in cars than we export. That is twice as much as our total agriculture exports. So when you hear about the farmers are alarmed about tariffs on manufactured goods and things of that nature, people have zero perspective on what's really going on. And agriculture is crucial. Agriculture is a wonderful part of our economy. I love farmers. Their primary role in our society is to feed our people, not as an export market. It's terrific that we have agricultural exports, but the idea that we should not be moving aggressively, as President Trump is doing, to try to even the playing field in the manufacturing sector because we might face some retaliation in the agriculture sector is ridiculous. Again, just the deficit in cars in this country, imports over exports, is twice as much as our total agriculture exports.
Yeah, so just to give people an idea, you've cited that $20 billion of our surplus is in agriculture. So we run a surplus.
Right.
We sell more food than we buy, and that makes sense.
$20 billion.
But if we have a $130 billion deficit in automobiles alone, that problem is six times the size of the plus side we get from an ag surplus. And that, you know, you can understand that people have to be concerned. And like you, I have friends who are farmers and ranchers, and I want them to do well. But I don't want their business to be protected at the expense of a business that is far more consequential to Americans, as you point out, a $215 billion trade deficit in automobile vehicles, parts, and engines. That's a big hole,
right?
And you can't make it up with agriculture.
No, you can't. We're really almost in balance on agriculture. And when you figure in things like fishing and other products, that we're just about in balance there. What's crucial and what's killing us on our trade deficit is manufactured goods. And the reason that matters is that there are far more, per dollar of output, far more high-wage jobs created by manufacturing than by agriculture or any other sector, and including the services where we run surpluses. You know, a lot of that is financial services and banking, which is terrific for Wall Street traders and Wall Street executives. God love them. But I'm sorry, that is not what fuels the growth of high-wage jobs. And that's what's important to middle America, to most Americans, not only for the jobs directly created, but the ripple effect. Because when you have more demand for labor and higher wages, that raises the floor for everybody in the middle class. And that's what we've lost sight of, and that's what's been killing our middle class over the past 30 or 40 years. is this offshoring and outsourcing and importing orgy that we've had, which has just hollowed out middle America.
Well, and Lee, let me ask you about something, because I was thinking about this the other night. I listened to an interview with the with somebody from BMW, and they said the biggest BMW plant in the world is not in Europe. It's in the United States. So we have the big three, Ford, GM, and Chrysler. I drive a Ford. I don't have a dog in the fight, but I've driven a BMW in the past, many years ago. We also have the big three from Japan. You know, Nissan, Toyota, and Honda all have major plants in the United States. When we count those plants, do those count as American-made cars, or do those count as foreign cars because they have a foreign name on them? Do you know?
No, what we're talking about is where the metal is moving. So if the metal is moving, no matter who owns the plant, if it's moving from the United States overseas, that's considered an export. If it were an American company that manufactured, you know, a lot of American companies make parts overseas or source overseas, that counts as an import. So it doesn't matter who owns it, it's where it's made. And now, what you point out, and the thing that you mentioned with BMW is very important, because BMW is actually the biggest exporter of cars from the United States of all the companies, more than Ford, more than General Motors, more than Chrysler, is BMW.
That's
and what
stunning.
That means is there's nothing wrong with building in the United States. We can just have these guys do a lot more of it. That's why we need tariffs on car imports, because there are so many devious schemes that all the Germany, the Japan, and China, as they're moving into the car industry, are doing to stifle American imports and to push their exports, that we need a tariff just to equalize the playing field, because we can't possibly untangle all of the nefarious schemes that they use to push their exports and hurt imports from the United States.
Well, and just so people understand, Lee, I know this is a little bit of a dated example, but there was a point where America was trying to protect its domestic truck market. This was quite some time ago. And Subaru was making a pickup truck. And we said, well, we have to make sure we can make pickup trucks in case we have a conventional war. We need to make vehicles like that. And so they said, we're going to put a tariff on pickup trucks. So Subaru dropped a couple of plastic seats in the bed of a bunch of their pickup trucks. And they said, they're no longer pickup trucks, they're passenger cars. And they brought them in under that way because they found a way to make a pickup truck look like a passenger car. And I never owned one of them, but I had friends who did. And if you didn't like the seats, you know, about 20 minutes with a socket wrench and the seats were no longer in the bed of your pickup truck. But if you like the seats, you know, your friends like to get in the back and put on a seat belt and race around in the bed of a pickup truck, it worked out great. But that's just a small example of the kind of dodges they use to get around our regulations, where countries that have protectionist measures to keep our goods out then find other ways to sneak around our methods. I wish we could get to the point where people said, if I'm going to open an auto factory, I'm going to open it in America because it's the best place to build automobiles, and get the other countries to have to accept, if we're going to, if we want to be able to sell things to America, we have to buy things from America on the same basis. And my ideal position would be no tariffs either way. Lee Speakerman is with Speakerman Media, and it's First Amendment Friday.
Stop using DHS as a slush fund. We need to abolish ICE and end all inhumane deportation and detention programs.
Unbelievable. That's Ilhan Omar, who is a Muslim member of Congress, one of two in the Congress right now. The other one is Rashida Tlaib from Michigan. And she's arguing that we should do away with all enforcement of immigration laws because the Border Patrol takes care of the borders of our country and to about 100 or 150 miles inside the border. But inside of those boundaries, enforcement of immigration law is done by ICE. And this is literally a member of Congress arguing that ICE should be done away with and that we should no longer deport people from our country simply because they're in the country illegally. It's an outrageous position, but it gives you an idea of just how extreme somebody like Ilhan Omar is. Welcome to First Amendment Friday. This is the Lars Larson Show. We supply honestly provocative talk radio for the United States of America. And by that, I mean I'll always be honest with you. I'll never tell you something that I don't really believe and something I don't think I can back up with real evidence. But on top of that, I want to be provocative. I think about things a lot, as you can tell by listening to the show. And I want to provoke you to think about some of the issues that are up against us. And don't take the simplistic view. I try not to make up my mind about a subject until I've gone out and studied it. So one of the other hallmarks of this program is naysayers go to the head of the line, like George. Or would you prefer I call you Jorge?
I go by both.
Okay. Well, Jorge, welcome to the program. You're a naysayer. What do you and I disagree about on a First Amendment Friday night?
I voted for Trump, and I tend to vote for Trump again, but I disagree with his immigration policy. I have both problems with the merit system and the language requirement. First of all, with the merit system, I don't know if you realize it or not, but Marco Rubio's parents were a bartender and a maid. They probably wouldn't have made it in this country under the merit system, yet their son went on to be a U.S. senator. I have an aunt who came to this country, and she didn't speak a lick of English and never learned it in her entire life. She managed to get a certificate as a manicurist. Her son graduated with honor from the University of Miami, and her grandson is now finish his first year at Harvard Law. So these kind of people would probably excluded under Donald Trump's system, and I think it's wrong.
All right, Jorge, let me afford an argument back the other direction. If you say that the United States cannot afford to take in everyone from everywhere in the world who would like to come, can we agree on that?
Yes, I'm talking about legal immigration,
but
illegal.
Jorge, we're going to run out of time if we get into I'm just asking you, can we accept that in a planet of 7.5 billion, soon to be 8 billion, that we can't take all of the people who desire to come to the United States? So the question is, should we take in people who are at least capable of supporting themselves? And let me throw a number at you. We have a welfare system in this country, food stamps, Section 8 housing, Medicaid, and that sort of thing. Dozens of federal programs, hundreds of state-level programs to provide for people who cannot even manage to provide for themselves. They cannot earn enough money to have food to eat, a house, a roof over their heads, that sort of thing. Among immigrants, both legal and illegal, those on the welfare system are double the number of people who are native-born Americans. Now, we've all heard the stories about somebody who came to America poor. I've met people. I've done stories about people who came here very poor, but they went out and they were industrious, and they did more than provide for themselves. They started companies and actually employed a lot of other people. The problem is, if we have a disproportionate number, twice as many immigrants on welfare as native-born, and I think there are too many native-born on welfare, I think we should make it, unless you're physically or mentally disabled or too old, I think you should be able to at least provide for yourself and preferably for the family around you, if possible. So my question is, if we are building a huge dependent class of people who are not even able to provide for themselves, and in some cases, because they refuse to learn the language, I don't know why your family member never learned the language when she was in a country where learning English makes you much more capable, not just economically, but also in interacting with other people. How do you interact with people if you don't speak the language? Should we allow that giant dependent class, or should we say the majority of people who come to this country should be capable of providing for themselves?
Well, if you want to use public assistance as a criteria, the number one people that are public assistance, if you look at it on a racial basis, happens to be Caucasian.
I'm not looking at it racial. Jorge, you're advancing a ridiculous argument. The majority of almost everything in this country is going to be Caucasian because the majority of the people in the country are Caucasian. But what I'm telling you is immigrants outnumber native-born 2-1 when it comes to welfare. So if you say that's a problem and you won't even acknowledge that it's a problem, do you think it's a good thing for people to come to this country and then to say, I'm going to be dependent on the system for the rest of my life? Because I also suspect that an awful lot of kids who grow up in a dependent household may in fact become dependent themselves. I think one of the positives for a young kid, boy or girl, is to see a mom and dad who go off to work and they earn their own living. having a mom and dad who say, the government provides our housing, the government provides our food, the government provides our medicine, is not a healthy thing for kids. Can we agree on that?
Sure, but that doesn't mean that the second or third generation aren't going to pull ahead and be successful. We have plenty of examples of people who have been poor and been on welfare.
Yeah, but George, can we wait? George, can we wait for the second or third? Because right now, this country, as rich as we are, our schools are overcrowded. Our roads are overcrowded. Our infrastructure needs repair. We are short of housing. We're short of a lot of things to make the kind of life that we have in this country. I want this country to continue to be a great country. And I'm in favor of having people come here who actually have some skills and are able at least to provide their own and for their own, rather than saying, I will be dependent on you for the rest of your my life. I don't think I can change your mind, but you've had your argument and I've had mine. Susan, welcome to First Amendment Friday. What's on your mind?
Hi. It was interesting to hear the study coming out of England about the connection between THC use and psychosis.
This is the one that Ann Coulter cited, and she cited it before. Just so people know what we're talking about, Susan, good university studies that say if you are using the average grade marijuana in those places where it's legalized in America, you're three times more likely to go psychotic. That doesn't mean it'll be a huge number, but three times more likely is dangerous. If you're using the higher grade marijuana, you're five times more likely to go psychotic. What do you make of that? Because the folks already know what I make of that.
From personal observation, and I used to be a proponent of legalizing marijuana. And I am not, and I was never a user either. My son had a huge chance of becoming schizophrenic in the first place from severe ADHD when he couldn't get medication from the doctors for his social anxiety because it was too addictive. He turned to street medication or drugs, marijuana being one of them.
Yeah.
We've had to commit him numerous times at this point, and each time he's had a psychotic break from reality, he comes back with less of the person that we knew.
That is a tragic story, Susan, and that's what I'm concerned about. So many states have found it's popular and it's cool to legalize pot for recreational purposes, and then you find out it's literally making some people crazy and dangerous. Back in just a moment, you're listening to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show. Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's First Amendment Friday night. Glad to be with you and glad to take your phone calls and emails. You know, I know that one of the things that, while Christian Toto from HollywoodandToto.com, Christian and I have some things in common. One of the things we don't have in common is that I've been following every last second of Game of Thrones, whereas for Christian, it may have to be a binge watch later on this year, maybe later this decade. Right, Christian?
Yeah, you know, I missed the boat, and the thought of catching up now has been so oppressive. Everyone I talk to said they almost take notes when they watch the show. It's that dense. There's so many different names, so many different legacies and feuds, and it just seems amazingly confusing, and I just missed it. So I'll have to spend like a few months, or maybe, you know, just take my time and go through it all. But in this pop culture moment, I am just behind the curve, and I'm sorry.
Well, listen, take heart, Christian, because I'll give you two examples. One, my wife just flat refused to watch Breaking Bad, which I thought was it was a disturbing series, but it was interesting. And so one time on a flight to the East Coast, I watched, I think, three episodes, and I came home and I said, listen, I know you know, when you said, I think her words were, I don't want to watch a series about a high school teacher who becomes a meth dealer. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, watch three of them for me, invest that much time. And if after three of them, you still don't like them, then we can give it up. I think she was two thirds of the way through the first episode when she was saying, this is great. I mean, it's disturbing, but many films that are good films are disturbing in one way or another. And she binged the rest. And we did that, I think, in the last year that it was still, you know, where new episodes were coming out. So we literally binged over a series of weeks where we'd watch one or two or three of them every night, and we caught up. And then it was a matter of, oh my God, it's going to be a week till we see the next one. And she was enthusiastic about it. We also binged Making a Murderer over a Christmas vacation with a whole crowd of people that we were with for Christmas, and then came back, and everybody on television was talking about Making a Murderer, and that's the nonfiction documentary series. So you can catch up, but it is amazingly complicated. When you think about, 80 episodes, it would take a while to catch up.
Yeah, and just the nature of the storytelling is dense, and you almost have to watch each episode twice from what I understand, just to get it all, get all the nuances and the relationships. It's not easy, but the barrier to entry is sort of worth the wait, I guess.
So what are the big new movies coming out this weekend? Or the ones, I don't want to say big. Sometimes my favorite movies are not the ones that make big box office, but what are the best new movies coming out this weekend?
Well, the one I want to focus on is John Wick Chapter 3 Parabellum. Now, this is a franchise you either love or hate, and it really depends on your... I do, too, and it depends on your appreciation for violence. These movies are ultra-violent, and it's a kind of violence where, even as a movie critic, and I'm kind of numb to movie violence at times, I've seen so much of it, even I cringe in my seat and twist and turn. It's uncomfortable, but it's really beautifully orchestrated. It's almost like a ballet of violence going on, and this movie is just like the last two. Keanu Reeves is very good in this role. He doesn't have to say much, doesn't have to emote that much, but he is a great physical action hero. I think he's in his mid-50s now, and boy, if I can move like that, I'd be very happy. It's mesmerizing, and again, it's as violent as you can imagine, and if you don't like that, stay far away, but if you've enjoyed the first two installments, this is another really rousing adventure.
Well, I got to tell you, Christian, one of the things I like about it, and I think some conservatives say, you don't like that stuff, do you? It's kind of gratuitous violence where it's eye candy, like I say it. I say, no, what I like about it is that while not, you know, John Wick himself is not without sins, that when the bad guys get it good from the good guy, who's at least in relative terms the good guy, I think we like that. I liked that in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, where there was good and there was evil, and you were rooting for good to win, but you knew there was a chance that evil could win as well. That I have a hunger for that kind of thing. And the more everything is gray, everybody is bad, nobody is really very good idea that I think Hollywood loves to shovel out to us, I don't like those movies very much at all.
Yeah, and I think the one point about John Wick is that even though he's killing lots and lots of bad guys, you know deep down, if he could, he would be in a cabin by himself with his dog, maybe having a nice meal to himself. He seems like a serene, peaceful fellow who is just, by the events happening in each film, is forced into all this violence and mayhem. You just can sense that, but he has to do what he has to do to survive, and that means taking down a lot of people.
Now, I want to ask you something that's a little bit inside baseball. I do a conservative talk show. I've done it for about a quarter of a century. I like conservative talk. I've tried to listen to liberal talk. It has died many deaths in America. They still haven't figured out a successful way to have liberal talk shows. And I think I understand why on radio. It's also never been a thing on late night television. It's dominated by lefties. And I'll tell you, Christian, as a free market guy, I always figure if there's something that people would like to see, then the marketplace will supply it. And it stuns me that the marketplace says anybody up late at night, which includes me some nights, is only going to want liberal nonsense on late night talk show hosts. Why hasn't there been a conservative late night talk show?
The term show business is tricky because, like you said, it sounds like the market forces should prevail. But a comedian who is right of center, Michael Loftus, talked about this recently on a podcast. He said he pitched a show that wasn't even right-leaning. It was more fair and balanced, hit the left, hit the right. And he said that several people he spoke to about it, including a streaming service, a syndication service, and a network, looked at his concept, said, looks good, sounds good, I like it, but we can't accept this because it would show that maybe we're being too kind to people right of center. That's what he reports. That's what he said he heard. And maybe that's partly the reason why there is not a single show that caters to Red State America.
And that's pretty sad because it says, I mean, look, in publishing, they'll publish almost anything. There are books for every person of every point of view. And there and I think the same thing is true in music. I mean, there's an awful lot of music that I don't reject because it's modern. I mean, I like to do needle drops on new music, even the stuff from people I've never heard of. The only thing that offends me are the music that speaks disparagingly of women, of men, of society, of the police, of the military, an awful lot of hip-hop, garbage. And I kind of tend toward more like my country's a good place to be. There may be bad things happening, but it's a good place to be. So I kind of wonder when one particular area says, nope, we couldn't do that, because then we'd be being fair to the conservatives. And in America, everybody in the entertainment business has to disparage conservative Americans. I don't think that's very American.
I don't think so either. And I think it should be a bigger story. I mean, I reported on it. I don't know how many other outlets did. But that kind of discrimination is just wrong. And at the end of the day, there's half the country waiting for a late night show that they can watch and enjoy and laugh at and feel like they're being spoken to. Why on earth wouldn't a station try that? It's worth the effort.
I'll tell you what, somebody's going to open up a cable network or cable channel, because Christian, think about all those cable channels. There are like 900 or 1,000 of them, and we could always have more. You can find what he writes at HollywoodToto.com. It's First Amendment Friday. Your calls are welcome at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com.
Unusual situation to have opposition research like that, especially one that on its face had a number of clear mistakes and a somewhat jejune analysis, and to use that to conduct counterintelligence against an American political campaign would be a strange development.
And that is Attorney General William Barr talking about the very fact that is probably the reason an awful lot of Democrats are beside themselves with the fact that Barr is going to be investigating the investigation. He's going to find out why it was that the Bob Mueller investigation happened at all, what exactly sparked it. And if you think that's an obscure little academic point, understand what he's saying. And it's something we've talked about on this show over the last 2 years, as we've watched Bob Mueller spend about $35 million of the American taxpayers' money doing an investigation that it now seems clear Bob Mueller himself knew was unwarranted within about the first 6 months of the investigation. But the Democrats wanted it. And why? Because they were convinced that Bob Mueller would find obstruction by President Trump. And he didn't. They were convinced that Bob Mueller would find that Donald Trump was connected somehow to the hacking of emails at the Democrat National Committee. And Bob Mueller did not. And they were convinced that Bob Mueller would find that there was collusion, not a crime, so let's call it conspiracy, which is what it was, an allegation that President Trump engaged in a conspiracy with Vladimir Putin and the Russians to affect the outcome of the 2016 election. And one more time, you're 0-for-3, Bob Mueller found that none of the things the Democrats said were true. The ones that folks like Adam Schiff, member of Congress, he said he had undeniable proof that this had actually happened. Well, since the Bob Mueller investigation didn't find it, a lot of us have been asking Adam Schiff, hey, Congressman, if you've got information that Bob Mueller didn't find using $35 million, almost 2 years of investigation, a whole team of lawyers, and he couldn't find it. He couldn't find it when he served 500 search warrants. He couldn't find it when he issued 2,700 subpoenas. He couldn't find it in the hundreds of thousands of pages of documents. He couldn't find it in any of those places, but somehow Adam Schiff from California had found the proof positive that Donald Trump was in fact a corrupt president. Well, if you've got it, Adam Schiff, put up or shut up as far as I'm concerned. And now AG Barr is looking into where this all began. And I think what he's going to find is this. He's going to find that the entire investigation was driven by a Department of Justice and an FBI, not at the bottom ranks, but at the top ranks, that was thoroughly corrupt. And we even know the names of the corrupt figures, people like James Comey, people like Andrew McCabe, people like Peter Strzok, and people like Lisa Page, not to mention Bruce Orr. And Bruce Orr is probably one of the most interesting parts of all of this, because Bruce Orr is married to a woman who works for the company Fusion GPS that was hired by the Hillary Clinton presidential campaign to dig dirt on President Trump, then candidate Donald Trump. And they worked together with the DNC and paid a lot of money, the estimate is $16 million, to dig as much dirt as they possibly could on Donald Trump. And they couldn't find enough legitimate, real dirt, so they hired a former British secret agent, Christopher Steele, and they said, if we give you a pile of money, do you think you can come up with some dirt? And do you know what he did? He went to his Russian contacts in the Russian government, and they said, oh, we've got all kinds of things for you. If you pay us enough money, why, we'd be glad to come up with any story you want. And they came up with a bunch of cockamamie stories, stories that Donald Trump had hired prostitutes to urinate on a bed that had once been occupied by Barack and Michelle Obama. I mean, crazy stuff like that. And they took the Steele dossier and they tried to shop it around to all the television networks prior to the election. And that didn't do any good, because the television networks, even the television networks that seem to love anything that is salacious, I mean, they'll bite on almost anything. They looked at that and said, boy, without some corroboration, we're not touching that with a 10-foot pole. So then they took it to the DOJ. And the DOJ took it to a federal judge and presented it as though it had been carved on stone tablets and brought down from the burning bush on the top of a mountain. And they said, judge, this shows that there is some kind of bad stuff going on between Russia and candidate Donald Trump. And we'd like to start wiretapping some people, people like Carter Page. I mean, this is the story that we all know so very, very well. And what I've been telling you from the beginning is that we know where there was a conspiracy between an American actor by the name of Hillary Clinton. By actor, I'm using that in the generic sense. She is a person in America who wanted to be president. And she decided that if you cheat enough, that your opponent, Bernie Sanders, can't even get the nomination. If you cheat by maintaining a secret email server, if you cheat by erasing government documents in violation of the law, if you cheat by treating classified documents as though they're, you know, a magazine you picked up at the corner convenience store, if you cheat enough, you can become president of the United States. And we also know that there were actors within the FBI, like Strzok and Page, who were scared to death that this information was going to get out. They needed, as they put it, an insurance policy to make sure that Donald Trump was never elected, because they could get away with all kinds of things as long as they knew that Hillary Clinton would be the president. Why? Because if Hillary was the president, none of us would know any of what we know today, that there was no collusion with Trump. There was no obstruction by Trump. There was no hacking by Trump. None of that. But what we do know is there was cheating by the Hillary Clinton campaign and by the DNC. In fact, the cheating within the DNC, which was only revealed because of WikiLeaks releasing those emails from the DNC, it was so bad that there were people who were ousted from the leadership of the DNC. Remember Debbie Wasserman Schultz? Ousted from the leadership because of all the cheating that was going on within the party. And we know that Hillary Clinton had gone to the party early on when she wanted to be the candidate. And she said, you got money troubles and I've got money. And I have troubles because I want to be the nominee. So let's put our heads together. I will solve your money problems if you make sure that I'm the nominee. And more cheating went on. Bernie Sanders, and this is something Democrats, I know some of you are Democrats, about a third of my audience is self-described liberal progressives. I know that there are people out there who ought to be angry that the candidate they favored, Bernie Sanders, not my favorite candidate, but he was the favorite of a lot of Americans, tens of millions of Americans who sent him money, who voted for him, who wanted him as the nominee, that opportunity was taken away by cheating, not by Donald Trump and Russia, but by Hillary Clinton and Russia and Christopher Steele and the DNC, and also the FBI and the Department of Justice, and likely folks like Mr. Clapper at the National Security Agency. All of that, Director of National Security, National Intelligence, I should say, DNI. So all of that cheating was going on, and Americans should be scared to death of this kind of thing happening to our country, because if ever whether it's Republican or Democrat, the party in power can use the power of being the party in power to make sure that its side always stays in power, then democracy and representative government in this country is simply over. It's First Amendment Friday. Glad to have you with me. And every topic is fair game on First Amendment Fridays. And of course, naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. When we come back, we'll talk about manufacturing, a bedrock export for America. But are we pushing cars and trucks at the cost of corn and pigs? Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is a First Amendment Friday. Your calls are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Our Twitter poll today, should a diversity score from growing up poor boost your college SAT numbers? I would answer that no, but now apparently the Scholastic Aptitude Test Company is going to add a diversity score. So if you grew up in a poor neighborhood, or if you had poor parents, or if you had some other things that are seen as obstacles to your being educated, they're going to add an extra score and enhance your college SAT scores. It's the most phony baloney thing I've ever heard of. But the aim is apparently to try to allow institutions of higher education to engage in racism, to give extra points to people, but they can't use race. So they have to find other criteria that they can measure, which will tilt in the direction of giving an edge to some of the kids, mostly black kids and Hispanic kids, to give them an extra edge on those SAT scores without actually saying we're doing it about race. It's sneaky, it's conniving, and it's wrong. You can vote in it at Lars Larson Show on Twitter or LarsLarson.com on the web. I mentioned manufacturing as a bedrock for America. Some of the biggest exports we have are Boeing airplanes and Caterpillar tractors and cars and trucks and things like that. Lee Speakerman joins me now from Speakerman Media. Lee, good to have you back on a First Amendment Friday.
Great to be on, Lars.
So you're concerned about the fact that perhaps in deciding which kinds of trade we get concerned about and whether or not we're being treated equitably overseas, that we don't put as much attention, perhaps, on manufacturing as we do on agriculture. Can you give my audience an idea of your perspective on where we ought to be putting the focus?
Well, we definitely should be focused on manufacturing, and this farm export alarm is ridiculous. As I pointed out on Twitter today, we have in this country a $215 billion trade deficit just on auto vehicles, parts, and engines. $215 billion. Of that, $130 billion is just cars. In other words, we import $130 billion more in cars than we export. That is twice as much as our total agriculture exports. So when you hear about the farmers are alarmed about tariffs on manufactured goods and things of that nature, people have zero perspective on what's really going on. And agriculture is crucial. Agriculture is a wonderful part of our economy. I love farmers. Their primary role in our society is to feed our people, not as an export market. It's terrific that we have agricultural exports, but the idea that we should not be moving aggressively, as President Trump is doing, to try to even the playing field in the manufacturing sector because we might face some retaliation on in the agriculture sector is ridiculous. Again, the deficit in cars in this country, imports over exports, is twice as much as our total agriculture exports.
Yeah, so just to give people an idea, you've cited that $20 billion of our surplus is in agriculture. So we run a surplus.
Right.
We sell more food than we buy, and that makes sense.
$20
billion. But if we have a $130 billion deficit in automobiles alone, that problem is six times the size of the plus side we get from an ag surplus. And that, you know, you can understand that people have to be concerned. And like you, I have friends who are farmers and ranchers, and I want them to do well. But I don't want their business to be protected at the expense of a business that is far more consequential to Americans, as you point out, a $215 billion trade deficit in automobile vehicles, parts, and engines. That's a big hole,
right?
And you can't make it up with agriculture.
No, you can't. We're really almost in balance on agriculture. And then when you figure in things like fishing and other products, that we're just about in balance there. What's crucial and what's killing us on our trade deficit is manufactured goods. And the reason that matters is that there are far more, per dollar of output, far more high-wage jobs created by manufacturing than by agriculture or any other sector, and including the services where we run surpluses. You know, a lot of that is financial services and banking, which is terrific for Wall Street traders and Wall Street executives. God love them. But I'm sorry, that is not what fuels the growth of high-wage jobs. And that's what's important to middle America, to most Americans, not only for the jobs directly created, but the ripple effect. Because when you have more demand for labor and higher wages, that raises the floor for everybody in the middle class. And that's what we've lost sight of, and that's what's been killing our middle class over the past 30 or 40 years, is this offshoring and outsourcing and importing orgy that we've had, which has just hollowed out middle America.
Well, and Lee, let me ask you about something, because I was thinking about this the other night. I listened to an interview with the with somebody from BMW, and they said the biggest BMW plant in the world is not in Europe. It's in the United States. So we have the big three, Ford, GM, and Chrysler. I drive a Ford. I don't have a dog in the fight, but I've driven a BMW in the past, many years ago. We also have the big three from Japan. You know, Nissan, Toyota, and Honda all have major plants in the United States. When we count those plants, do those count as American-made cars, or do those count as foreign cars because they have a foreign name on them? Do you know?
No. What we're talking about is where the metal is moving. So if the metal is moving, no matter who owns the plant, if it's moving from the United States overseas, that's considered an export. If it were an American company that manufactured, you know, a lot of American companies make parts overseas or source overseas, that counts as an import. So it doesn't matter who owns it, it's where it's made. And now what you point out, and the thing that you mentioned with BMW is very important, because BMW is actually the biggest exporter of cars from the United States of all the companies, more than Ford, more than General Motors, more than Chrysler, is BMW.
That's
and what that
stunning.
Means is there's nothing wrong with building in the United States. We can just have these guys do a lot more of it. That's why we need tariffs on car imports, because there are so many devious schemes that all the Germany, the Japan, and China, as they're moving into the car industry, are doing to stifle American imports and to push their exports, that we need a tariff just to equalize the playing field, because we can't possibly untangle all of the nefarious schemes that they use to push their exports and hurt imports from the United States.
Well, and just so people understand, Lee, I know this is a little bit of a dated example, but there was a point where America was trying to protect its domestic truck market. This was quite some time ago. And Subaru was making a pickup truck. And we said, well, we have to make sure we can make pickup trucks in case we have a conventional war. We need to make vehicles like that. And so they said, we're going to put a tariff on pickup trucks. So Subaru dropped a couple of plastic seats in the bed of a bunch of their pickup trucks. And they said, they're no longer pickup trucks, they're passenger cars. And they brought them in right under that way, because they found a way to make a pickup truck look like a passenger car. And I never owned one of them, but I had friends who did. And if you didn't like the seats, you know, about 20 minutes with a socket wrench and the seats were no longer in the bed of your pickup truck. But if you like the seats, you know, your friends like to get in the back and put on a seatbelt and race around in the bed of a pickup truck, it worked out great. But that's just a small example of the kind of dodges they use to get around our regulations, where countries that have protectionist measures to keep our goods out then find other ways to sneak around our methods. I wish we could get to the point where people said, if I'm going to open an auto factory, I'm going to open it in America because it's the best place to build automobiles, and get the other countries to have to accept, if we're going to, if we want to be able to sell things to America, we have to buy things from America on the same basis. And my ideal position would be no tariffs either way. Lee Speakerman is with Speakerman Media, and it's First Amendment Friday.
Stop using DHS as a slush fund. We need to abolish ICE and end all inhumane deportation and detention programs.
Unbelievable. That's Ilhan Omar, who is a Muslim member of Congress, one of two in the Congress right now. The other one is Rashida Tlaib from Michigan. And she's arguing that we should do away with all enforcement of immigration laws because the Border Patrol takes care of the borders of our country and to about 100 or 150 miles inside the border. But inside of those boundaries, enforcement of immigration law is done by ICE. And this is literally a member of Congress arguing that ICE should be done away with and that we should no longer deport people from our country simply because they're in the country illegally. It's an outrageous position, but it gives you an idea of just how extreme somebody like Ilhan Omar is. Welcome to First Amendment Friday. This is the Lars Larson Show. We supply honestly provocative talk radio for the United States of America. And by that, I mean I'll always be honest with you. I'll never tell you something that I don't really believe and something I don't think I can back up with real evidence. But on top of that, I want to be provocative. I think about things a lot, as you can tell by listening to the show. And I want to provoke you to think about some of the issues that are up against us. And don't take the simplistic view. I try not to make up my mind about a subject until I've gone out and studied it. So one of the other hallmarks of this program is naysayers go to the head of the line, like George, or would you prefer I call you Jorge?
I go by both.
Okay. Well, Jorge, welcome to the program. You're a naysayer. What do you and I disagree about on a First Amendment Friday night?
I voted for Trump, and I tend to vote for Trump again, but I disagree with his immigration policy. I have both problems with the merit system and the language requirement. First of all, with the merit system, I don't know if you realize it or not, but Marco Rubio's parents were a bartender and a maid. They probably wouldn't have made it in this country under the merit system, yet their son went on to be a U.S. senator. I have an aunt who came to this country, and she didn't speak a lick of English and never learned it in her entire life. She managed to get a certificate as a manicurist. Her son graduated with honor from the University of Miami, and her grandson is now finished his first year at Harvard Law. So these kind of people would probably be excluded under Donald Trump's system, and I think it's wrong.
All right, Jorge, let me afford an argument back the other direction. If you say that the United States cannot afford to take in everyone from everywhere in the world who would like to come, can we agree on that?
Yes, I'm talking about legal immigration,
but
illegal.
Jorge, we're going to run out of time if we get into I'm just asking you, can we accept that in a planet of 7.5 billion, soon to be 8 billion, that we can't take all of the people who desire to come to the United States? So the question is, should we take in people who are at least capable of supporting themselves? And let me throw a number at you. We have a welfare system in this country, food stamps, Section 8 housing, Medicaid, and that sort of thing. Dozens of federal programs, hundreds of state-level programs to provide for people who cannot even manage to provide for themselves. They cannot earn enough money to have food to eat, a house, a roof over their heads, that sort of thing. Among immigrants, both legal and illegal, those on the welfare system are double the number of people who are native-born Americans. Now, we've all heard the stories about somebody who came to America poor. I've met people. I've done stories about people who came here very poor, but they went out and they were industrious and they did more than provide for themselves. They started companies and actually employed a lot of other people. The problem is, if we have a disproportionate number, twice as many immigrants on welfare as native-born, and I think there are too many native-born on welfare, I think we should make it, unless you're physically or mentally disabled or too old, I think you should be able to at least provide for yourself and preferably for the family around you, if possible. So my question is, if we are building a huge dependent class of people who are not even able to provide for themselves, and in some cases, because they refuse to learn the language. I don't know why your family member never learned the language when she was in a country where learning English makes you much more capable, not just economically, but also in interacting with other people. How do you interact with people if you don't speak the language? Should we allow that giant dependent class, or should we say the majority of people who come to this country should be capable of providing for themselves?
Well, if you want to use public assistance as a criteria, the number one people that are on public assistance, if you look at it on a racial basis, happens to be Caucasian.
I'm not looking at it racial. But hold on, Jorge. You're advancing a ridiculous argument. The majority of almost everything in this country is going to be Caucasian because the majority of the people in the country are Caucasian. But what I'm telling you is immigrants outnumber native-born 2-1 when it comes to welfare. So if you say that's a problem and you won't even acknowledge that it's a problem, do you think it's a good thing for people to come to this country and then to say, I'm going to be dependent on the system for the rest of my life? Because I also suspect that an awful lot of kids who grow up in a dependent household may in fact become dependent themselves. I think one of the positives for a young kid, boy or girl, is to see a mom and dad who go off to work and they earn their own living. Having a mom and dad who say, the government provides our housing, the government provides our food, the government provides our medicine, is not a healthy thing for kids. Can we agree on that?
Sure, but that doesn't mean that the second or third generation aren't going to pull ahead and be successful. We have plenty of examples of people who have been poor and been on welfare.
Yeah, but George, can we wait? Can we wait for the second or third? Because right now, this country, as rich as we are, our schools are overcrowded. Our roads are overcrowded. Our infrastructure needs repair. We are short of housing. We're short of a lot of things to make the kind of life that we have in this country. I want this country to continue to be a great country. And I'm in favor of having people come here who actually have some skills and are able at least to provide their own and for their own, rather than saying, I will be dependent on you for the rest of my life. I don't think I can change your mind, but you've had your argument and I've had mine. Susan, welcome to First Amendment Friday. What's on your mind?
Hi. It was interesting to hear the study coming out of England about the connection between THC use and psychosis.
This is the one that Ann Coulter cited, and she cited it before, just so people know what we're talking about, Susan. Good university studies that say if you are using the average grade marijuana in those places where it's legalized in America, you're 3 times more likely to go psychotic. That doesn't mean it'll be a huge number, but 3 times more likely is dangerous. If you're using the higher grade marijuana, you're 5 times more likely to go psychotic. What do you make of that? Because the folks already know what I make of that.
From personal observation, and I used to be a proponent of legalizing marijuana, and I am not, and I was never a user either. My son had a huge chance of becoming schizophrenic in the first place from severe ADHD when he couldn't get medication from the doctors for his social anxiety because it was too addictive. He turned to street medication or drugs, marijuana being one of them.
Yeah.
We've had to commit him numerous times at this point, and each time he's had a psychotic break from reality, he comes back with less of the person that we knew.
That is a tragic story, Susan, and that's what I'm concerned about. So many states have found it's popular and it's cool to legalize pot for recreational purposes, and then you find out it's literally making some people crazy and dangerous. Back in just a moment, you're listening to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show. Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's First Amendment Friday night. Glad to be with you and glad to take your phone calls and emails. You know, I know that one of the things that, while Christian Toto from HollywoodandToto.com, Christian and I have some things in common. One of the things we don't have in common is that I've been following every last second of Game of Thrones. Whereas for Christian, it may have to be a binge watch later on this year, maybe later this decade. Right, Christian?
Yeah, you know, I missed the boat, and the thought of catching up now has been so oppressive. Everyone I talked to said they almost take notes when they watch the show. It's that dense. There's so many different names, so many different legacies and feuds, and it just seems amazingly confusing, and I just missed it. So I'll have to spend like a few months, or maybe, you know, just take my time and go through it all. But in this pop culture moment, I am just behind the curve, and I'm sorry.
Well, listen, take heart, Christian, because I'll give you two examples. One, my wife just flat refused to watch Breaking Bad, which I thought was it was a disturbing series, but it was interesting. And so one time on a flight to the East Coast, I watched, I think, three episodes, and I came home and I said, listen, I know you know, when you said, I think her words were, I don't want to watch a series about a high school teacher who becomes a meth dealer. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, watch three of them for me, invest that much time. And if after three of them, you still don't like them, then we can give it up. I think she was two-thirds of the way through the first episode when she was saying, this is great. I mean, it's disturbing, but many films that are good films are disturbing in one way or another. And she binged the rest. And we did that, I think, in the last year that it was still, you know, where new episodes were coming out. So we literally binged over a series of weeks where we'd watch one or two or three of them every night. And we caught up. And then it was a matter of, oh, my God, it's going to be a week till we see the next one. And she was enthusiastic about it. We also binged Making a Murderer over a Christmas vacation with a whole crowd of people that we were with for Christmas. And then came back and everybody on television was talking about Making a Murderer. And that's the nonfiction documentary series. So you can catch up, but it is amazingly complicated. When you think about, 80 episodes, it would take a while to catch up.
Yeah, and just the nature of the storytelling is dense. And you almost have to watch each episode twice from one understand just to get it all, get all the nuances and the relationships. It's not easy, but the barrier to entry is sort of worth the wait, I guess.
So what are the big new movies coming out this weekend? Or the ones, I don't want to say big. Sometimes my favorite movies are not the ones that make big box office, but what are the best new movies coming out this weekend?
Well, the one I want to focus on is John Wick Chapter 3 Parabellum. Now, this is a franchise you either love or hate, and it really depends on your... I do too, and it depends on your appreciation for violence. These movies are ultra-violent, and it's a kind of violence where, even as a movie critic, and I'm kind of numb to movie violence at times, I've seen so much of it, even I cringe in my seat and twist and turn. It's uncomfortable, but it's really beautifully orchestrated. It's almost like a ballet of violence going on, and this movie is just like the last two. Keanu Reeves is very good in this role. He doesn't have to say much, doesn't have to emote that much, but he is a great physical action hero. I think he's in his mid-50s now, and boy, if I can move like that, I'd be very happy. It's mesmerizing, and again, it's as violent as you can imagine, and if you don't like that, stay far away, but if you've enjoyed the first two installments, this is another really rousing adventure.
Well, I got to tell you, Christian, one of the things I like about it, and I think some conservatives say, you don't like that stuff, do you? It's kind of gratuitous violence where it's eye candy, like I say it. I say, no, what I like about it is that while not, you know, John Wick himself is not without sins, that when the bad guys get it good from the good guy, who's at least in relative terms the good guy, I think we like that. I like that in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, where there was good and there was evil, and you were rooting for good to win, but you knew there was a chance that evil could win as well. That I have a hunger for that kind of thing. And the more everything is gray, everybody is bad, nobody is really very good idea that I think Hollywood loves to shovel out to us, I don't like those movies very much at all.
Yeah, and I think the one point about John Wick is that even though he's killing lots and lots of bad guys, you know deep down, if he could, he would be in a cabin by himself with his dog, maybe having a nice meal to himself. He seems like a serene, peaceful fellow who is just, by the events happening in each film, is forced into all this violence and mayhem. You just can sense that, but he has to do what he has to do to survive, and that means taking down a lot of people.
Now, I want to ask you something that's a little bit inside baseball. I do a conservative talk show. I've done it for about a quarter of a century. I like conservative talk. I've tried to listen to liberal talk. It has died many deaths in America. They still haven't figured out a successful way to have liberal talk shows. And I think I understand why on radio. It's also never been a thing on late night television. It's dominated by lefties. And I'll tell you, Christian, as a free market guy, I always figure if there's something that people would like to see, then the marketplace will supply it. And it stuns me that the marketplace says anybody up late at night, which includes me some nights, is only going to want liberal nonsense on late night talk show hosts. Why hasn't there been a conservative late night talk show?
The term show business is tricky because, like you said, it sounds like the market forces should prevail. But a comedian who was right of center, Michael Loftus, talked about this recently on a podcast. He said he pitched a show that wasn't even right-leaning. It was more fair and balanced, hit the left, hit the right. And he said that the several people he spoke to about it, including a streaming service, a syndication service, and a network, looked at his concept, said, looks good, sounds good, I like it, but we can't accept this because it would show that maybe we're being too kind to people right of center. That's what he reports. That's what he said he heard. And maybe that's partly the reason why there is not a single show that caters to Red State America.
And that's pretty sad because it says, I mean, look, in publishing, they'll publish almost anything. There are books for every person of every point of view. And I think the same thing is true in music. I mean, there's an awful lot of music that I don't reject because it's modern. I mean, I like to do needle drops on new music, even the stuff from people I've never heard of. The only thing that offends me are the music that speaks disparagingly of women, of men, of society, of the police, of the military, an awful lot of hip hop, garbage. And I kind of tend toward more like my country's a good place to be. There may be bad things happening, but it's a good place to be. So I kind of wonder when one particular area says, nope, we couldn't do that, because then we'd be being fair to the conservatives. And in America, everybody in the entertainment business has to disparage conservative Americans. I don't think that's very American.
I don't think so either. And I think it should be a bigger story. I mean, I reported on it. I don't know how many other outlets did. But that kind of discrimination is just wrong. And at the end of the day, there's half the country waiting for a late night show that they can watch and enjoy and laugh at and feel like they're being spoken to. Why on earth wouldn't a station try that? It's worth the effort.
I'll tell you what, somebody's going to open up a cable network or cable channel because, Christian, think about all those cable channels. There are like 900 or 1,000 of them, and we could always have more. You can find what he writes at HollywoodToto.com. It's First Amendment Friday. Your calls are welcome at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com.
Harry, how long have you been here, Harry? And in that time, how often have you noticed earthquakes?
Well, I had two here. I had one here about 10, 12 years ago that shook the chimney off the back of my building over here. And, of course, that's the one that hit Castle Rock and tore the schools down. That's been about 12. And about 5 or 6 years ago, I had a good one shook me out of bed one night. And I thought I drank too much. God damn, the bed was waving around and woke me up out of slumber. And I thought, oh, hell, I didn't drink that much last night. I only had one drink. But the goddamn things were rocking around. And I heard the damnedest noise down here, come down here in the dishes. I got them along there, shook all the damn dishes off the kitchen wall. The whole goddamn down the floor. That's the only two good ones. They were dandies. Well, by God, the house was rocking right around. It's rolling.
What would you do, Harry, if Mount St. Helens erupts sometime soon?
Oh, I'd stay right here and watch it. Tell you about it. No, it's too far away from me. Couldn't hurt me. Hell, it's a mile through here, and it's all heavily timbered in here. And I'm 3,200 here, you see. The mountain's almost 10,000. It didn't hurt a damn thing if it spewed out some lava and rock down there. It couldn't get to me. But if it did, I'm the only one up here. It ain't going to hurt anybody but Truman Hill. It wouldn't miss nothing. I'm the only one who lives up here year-round. I live here year-round. I'm the only goddamn human being up. They just keep that road plowed out for me and a bunch of nitwits to drive up the timberline, get lost, fall in a crevice and break a goddamn leg.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get your phone calls and emails. We'll get to those just a bit later. I've always been fascinated with American history, but I don't know that much about it. I mean, I know the basics, and I think most Americans do. But when you dig into the details is when you find the really fascinating stories. I mean, everybody knows, yes, we declared that we would be independent. We fought a war with Great Britain. And then if you're in elementary or middle or high school, it kind of all just flows together as though we just became a new country. And you forget about the kind of battle that had to happen to make this country what it is. Well, Rick Atkinson has solved that problem for us. He is a best-selling author, Pulitzer Prize winner, and the author most recently of The British Are Coming, The War for America, Lexington to Princeton, 1775 to 1777. It's a pleasure to have you on the program, Mr. Atkinson.
Well, thanks. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you very much. And I want you to just launch into this, telling it from the British perspective, and by my read, the book is more from a British perspective. It's an entirely different story than American school children are used to hearing.
Take George III, our last king. We have a stereotype of him as kind of an overbearing nitwit who still minces across the stage in Hamilton, when in fact he was king for 60 years, and he's much more capable, he's much more nuanced than our stereotype of him. His papers are owned by Queen Elizabeth II, and she just recently agreed to open them up. And I was one of the first scholars allowed into Windsor Castle, which is where they're kept. I was there for a month going through the papers for the Revolutionary War period in particular. And we see in him a figure who, first of all, he's an interesting man. He's interested in many things from astronomy to farming. He's a good father, which is not always a given among monarchs in the 18th century. He's a loving husband. And we see that his perspective on what we, the Americans, are doing leads him to believe that if the American colonies are permitted to slip away, to fall out of the empire, then there will be rebellions in Ireland and Canada and the Sugar Islands and the West Indies and India. And this new British Empire, which had just been created in 1763 with British victory in the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War, we call it, that the empire would be no more. And so that's one of the reasons why he is willing to fight across 3,000 miles of open ocean in the age of sail for 8 years in a long, bloody effort to put down this insurrection by his own people.
And he was right to some extent that the British Empire was in its waning days, was it?
Well, he was right in the sense that the Americans slipping away would be costly to the empire. They lost, as a consequence of the war, the American Revolution, about a third of the landmass that they had in the British Empire. But he was quite wrong in the sense that it would be the end of British prosperity, the end of British influence in world affairs. Not only did Britain continue to thrive, and of course they then fought a very long war against Napoleon and France, but the empire that had begun to dissolve with our independence was regenerated in the 19th century, and Britain was bigger and greater than ever as a consequence of that. So that strategic miscalculation that he and his ministers made was pretty important. It's of a piece with miscalculations that they made about the depth of loyalty in this country. They believed that most Americans remained loyal to the crown, which was quite incorrect. There were plenty of loyalists here, and that's why the revolution is first and foremost a civil war. But the majority are clearly not aligned with the crown. So making those kinds of strategic miscalculations when you're 3,000 miles away, when news travels very slowly, when you, George III, have never been to America, he never actually left England in his whole long life, it caused them to misunderstand the fundamentals about the revolution and caused them to make errors predicated on strategic misconceptions.
So about that, do you think we miss something in American education when we don't educate kids that perhaps the crown had some legitimate grievances, just as the colonists had some legitimate grievances or concerns at the time?
They had a point of view that we ought to understand, that we ought to be tolerant of that point of view. The Civil War that was fought between 1775 and 1783 was quite brutal, and the rebels, the patriots, were really unsparing when it came to treatment of the loyalists. They would sometimes they would have their property appropriated. They were publicly shamed. They were jailed. Sometimes they were killed. Sometimes they would be placed in prison ships on the Hudson River, or they were, most egregious of them would be lowered into an old copper mine in Connecticut, 70 feet below ground, rock-walled cells known simply as hell. And the loyalists, with scholars today, think it's probably about 1 in 5 of all white Americans. Country of 2.5 million in those days, 500,000 of the 2.5 million are black slaves, but probably about 1 in 5, maybe a little less, of white Americans are fundamentally loyal to the crown. And they're, from their point of view, armed insurrection is either somewhere between treason and impolite. And I think that understanding how they were treated, what their point of view was, why they felt that way, is an important part of our history.
Was there a better way to have resolved it? I mean, could this have ever been resolved by America becoming sort of semi-autonomous, or were the British, was that simply not within the realm of possibilities for the British or for the colonists?
Well, that's a very good question. You know, I think the problem was that in the late 18th century, no one had really conceived of the idea, it had no traction, an idea of commonwealth, which of course is what the British have subsequently,
where exactly.
Canada, Australia, countries that have been part of the empire have an affiliation with the mother country while having their own independence and basically being quite alone in making their own decisions and judgments. That just was not something that occurred to anyone. Had there been a wise man who could have put forward that plan in a way that both the British and Americans would have accepted it, it possibly could have resolved things in a different way. It must be said that the British were extremely stubborn about some of the American demands. The Americans were stubborn about those demands, but the king was quite unyielding in believing that the Americans must acknowledge the primacy of Parliament, for example, that we were not going to have our own Parliament, which we would call Congress, that we must acknowledge that we were a subordinate part of this empire. And all of this comes out of the notion that an empire, the imperium that the British are running at that time, the colonies are really there to service the mother country, the heartbeat of the empire. We're to provide the raw goods, the raw materials, whether it's timber or wheat or other goods that come from here, furs. And then we buy from them the finished products. And this is the way the empire is working in the 18th century. It makes Britain rich. And the fact that we're not so crazy about this arrangement is something the British have trouble swallowing.
It is volume one of a trilogy about the Revolutionary War in America. Its author is Rick Atkinson. He's worked as a correspondent for The Washington Post. He's also won the Pulitzer Prize. The book is called The British Are Coming, The War for America, Lexington to Princeton, 1775 to 1777. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you. You can email me, talk@larslarson.com. Vote in our Twitter poll, @LarsLarsonShow on Twitter. Visit our website at LarsLarson.com for streaming info and the rest of that. And I'm really pleased to have with me Rick Atkinson, the winner of the Pulitzer Prize and the author most recently of The Beginning, a three-book trilogy. I guess that's a bit redundant. Volume one is The British Are Coming. Can we talk about some of the individual figures that you write about in this book? Let's start with Henry Knox. Who was Henry Knox?
Yeah, Henry Knox is a captivating figure. In 1775, when George Washington arrives in Cambridge outside Boston to take command of the new Continental Army, a 25-year-old, very overweight bookseller from Boston named Henry Knox appears on the scene, and he has spent some time in the local militia, and he's with an artillery company. He knows something about gunnery and engineering. It turns out he's a genius at it, and he will become the father of American artillery, probably our most proficient combat arms in our long history. And Knox, among other things, realizes that there are dozens of cannons that have been captured from the British at Fort Ticonderoga on Lake Champlain, a couple hundred miles from Boston at that time. And in the dead of winter in 1775-76, he sets off and gets those cannon at Ticonderoga and nearby Crown Point, puts them on sleds. He uses sleds and boats to bring them across snow and ice and bring them back to General Washington's army. And it's exactly what they need in order to have the firepower to force the British out of occupied Boston. This happens in March of 1776. And Knox will go on to become not only one of Washington's most trusted lieutenants, but one of the signal figures in our early history. He's later Secretary of War under President Washington.
Well, it's funny that you talk about a character like this, overweight, a bookseller, relatively young. It's almost like the kind of character that Hollywood would invent and we would find unbelievable to say, so you look at a movie and say, now who's going to help us win the day? I know this guy who's made his living selling books. He's only a couple of decades old, and he's not he doesn't cut the kind of strong heroic figure that, say, a General Washington does, who, as I understand, not just the father of our country, but hugely physically capable in his day as a soldier, and admired for all the right reasons because he was a heroic figure. Henry Knox is not exactly the heroic figure, but he makes a heroic play.
Well, that's true, and he will eventually weigh almost 300 pounds. He is kind of the antithesis to Washington in some respects. Washington he's almost 6 feet two, which is enormous in those days. Thomas Jefferson considered him the finest horseman of his age. He was agile and very athletic. He has traits that I think are worth studying and are worth emulating. Traits that we're looking for in our national leaders through our history. He's got dignity. He's got probity. He's honest. He's subordinate to civilian control of the military. He kind of invents that doctrine as he's going along. He believes in a cause larger than himself. He subordinates his own interests as a planner. He's away from Mount Vernon for 8 years. He only goes back to Mount Vernon once, briefly, in the whole 8 years of war. I find him very admirable. I spent 15 years with Dwight Eisenhower, metaphorically, in writing about World War II. And the more I spent time with Eisenhower, the more I admired him, and I'm feeling the same way about Washington.
I'm talking to Rick Atkinson, who's the author of The British Are Coming, the first in a three-book series about the Revolutionary War. Let's talk about some of the knaves that you write about, some of the people who are perhaps less than admirable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there are a lot of them because these are human beings. Well, you can start with Benedict Arnold, who actually is the finest combat leader on either side early in the war. He's a man born to lead other men in the dark of night, and we see him over and over again, whether it's leading 1,000 men through the Maine wilderness in the late fall of 1775 to appear at the gates of Quebec when we invaded Canada, or in fighting a pretty substantial British squadron on Lake Champlain, where Arnold, who knows how to sail and how to build boats, he's been a merchant and he's had his own little fleet. He commands the American squadron there and fights gallantly and delays the British invasion down into New York long enough to cause the British to pull back for the winter. He's an extraordinary combat hero. Now, of course, he's also got issues and he's got grievances. And we're going to see later in the war when he's a general, he's been wounded twice badly. He was wounded at Quebec. He's wounded again at Saratoga. And he doesn't feel like he's properly appreciated by the Congress or by his fellow Americans. And he's going to flip sides, famously. His name is now a synonym for treason. So he's a very complicated, interesting character.
What caused him to turn?
You know, part of it is he wanted some money. Part of it was that he felt that his service to the country had really not been appreciated, that other lesser men had been promoted over him and were given accolades and rank beyond him. There is some truth to that. He was the sort of man who accumulated enemies. His superiors tended to admire him very much and to recognize his great skills as a fighting soldier. Washington thought highly of him, for example. His subordinates tended to be constantly bickering with him. They're constantly nattering at him. They've got issues over the way that he enforces his commands. He's henpecked by these small men around him. And it feeds his grievances. It's inexcusable what he does. His name should be a synonym for treason, because he will come back as a British general and cause us great difficulties along Connecticut, where he was from, and in Virginia.
You know, a few years ago, I spent some time on a Canadian ship, a Canadian military ship. I haven't been in the military, but I was surprised that they had a bar on board the ship. And I thought, well, you'd never find that in the U.S. Navy. And yet, part of the detail you get into in writing this story, this first in the three-book series about the Revolutionary War, is that rum played a role for our troops. Explain that, would you please?
Yeah, well, rum was an important part of the diet. So on the British side, for example, a soldier was basically entitled to a gill of rum a day. That's 5 ounces. That's about a gallon a month. You're putting down some rum. And alcoholism was a serious issue. One of the reasons that rum was important was because of the lack of potable water. Clean water was hard to come by. And so rum, often weakened in some way, would be drunk with meals. For the British, trying to bring all that rum to America to supply the troops was an enormous shipping problem. I mean, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of gallons of rum a year. For the Americans, it's kind of part and parcel of the culture. When you don't have rum for the troops, sometimes rum was used to buck up their courage. There was a gill of rum, half a gill, I think it was, issued to troops before the Battle of Princeton in January 1777.
That's the one I was thinking about. I was trying to imagine a modern American military commander saying, "We're about to go into the battle. Everybody have a shot or two."
Yeah, just have a little nip. And some of them would sprinkle gunpowder in the rum because they believed that gunpowder helped to fortify your courage. So it's just part of the culture of that time.
I'm talking to Mr. Atkinson, Rick Atkinson, who's the author most recently of The British Are Coming. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. We'll get to your calls a bit later at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Twitter poll or Twitter account is @LarsLarsonShow. I'm talking to historian Rick Atkinson, who's worked as a correspondent. He's won the Pulitzer Prize. He's worked on many great books, both about World War II and, as he mentioned, Eisenhower. And now, most recently, The British Are Coming, the first of three books about the Revolutionary War. Can we talk a bit about what you write about with regard to sort of the rest of the population? You can read about the battles, you can read about the military commanders and the soldiers, but you talked about the fact that you found claims that had been put in by the widows of men killed in Lexington and Concord, and it was something they wanted that actually wouldn't be that surprising today. We, you know, when somebody dies, you hear about their effects being passed on to their family. These widows were looking for, what, any small token to remember their family members by who'd been lost?
Or looking for compensation. Yeah, effects are always very interesting in war because in World War II, there was an effects bureau in Kansas City, and there were thousands of people. It was a quartermaster operation working there to process the effects of the American dead from six continents. 60,000 shipments a month went through Kansas City in 1945. And the revolutionary period is not dissimilar. So you find claims put in from widows of husbands who've been killed with the Massachusetts militia at Bunker Hill, for example. And there's one that I refer to in the book where she asked for £5.12 in compensation for her husband's lost trousers, his pipe, his musket. She didn't have his effects, so she was looking for a little money in compensation. At other times, when the effects were recovered, which wasn't all that often, there would be a petition to recover his coat. It's interesting that there was a habit in the 18th century. So when General Richard Montgomery was killed at Quebec, when we were invading Canada, and the final assault on Quebec occurred on December 31st, 1775, and Montgomery, the commander of our expedition, was shot in both thighs and in the face, and his effects were auctioned off to his officers a couple days after his death. And there's a long list of what he had in his wardrobe. Captain Aaron Burr, who was part of that expedition, bought some of it. There's a volume, two volumes of Polybius, a volume of Johnson's Dictionary, certain signs of types of cambric shirts. Most of Montgomery's effects were bought by Benedict Arnold. And so we can assume that Arnold goes through the rest of the war, probably including his treason in 1780, wearing some of Montgomery's clothes.
Because they weren't buying these effects, at least the clothing, not the books, but the clothing, they weren't buying them the way somebody would buy something like if you owned an Elvis Presley's jacket. You're not buying them as a keepsake. You're actually buying them to wear, right?
Well, of course. And, if you're in the middle of the wilderness outside of Quebec, very remote at that time, you're looking for all the warm clothing and the useful things you can get. There's a pair of key tongs in Montgomery's effects that Arnold bought. And we can imagine that Benedict Arnold used these key tongs as part of his officer's mess. So, yes, there's very much a utilitarian quality to it. They're not buying it for sentimental reasons. They're not buying these things as keepsakes necessarily. They're buying them because they need them.
His book is called The British Are Coming. His name is Rick Atkinson, and you might be familiar with him already for his writings about World War II. Let me ask you about Washington, because I'm fascinated by Washington. But what you talk about is a commander who started out with kind of a dim view of the troops he was commanding, but that he evolved over a period of time. And it had to be a relatively quick evolution, given the length of the war and the conflict that was going on. When he first started as the commander of these American colonists, now the new country's colonists, what was his view toward them?
Well, let's remember he's a Virginian, of course, and he arrives in Massachusetts, Cambridge, just outside of Boston, in July 1775 to take command of the brand new Continental Army. Most of his soldiers, the overwhelming percentage, are New Englanders. And New England, Massachusetts, it's a foreign country compared to Virginia. They think of themselves as foreign countries. He had not had a whole lot of exposure to New Englanders. He writes about them in very disparaging terms. He writes about dirty New Englanders. He's exasperated by the low quality of the officers. He kind of goes on and on about it. And Washington does not understand. Let's remember, this is a guy with more than 300 slaves when he dies in 1799. And when he goes to take over the army in 1775, he has scores and scores of slaves to attend Mount Vernon while he's gone. He doesn't have to worry about taking care of Martha. He doesn't have to worry about taking care of the plantation. And he doesn't really understand the sacrifices being made by these men serving under him, officers and enlisted, leaving their farms, their small shops, leaving their families to go off and serve the cause. And this takes a while for Washington to appreciate this mystical bond between leader and led, which has been around in combat for thousands of years. It's perfectly understandable to officers and enlisted men today in our armed forces. And it takes Washington a while to, first of all, recognize the sacrifice that's being made to serve at his side and to understand that the shared travails, the few victories, the many defeats, the hardships of soldiering have to weld them together. The army is the indispensable institution in our early history. Washington is the indispensable man, And it's going to take them a little while to figure out how to dance together. It's a very interesting evolution. It's part of Washington being able to, great responsibility enlarges him. That doesn't happen to everybody.
Well, I was going to say, Mr. Atkinson, unlike, say, George Patton, who he had a tough demeanor, and I cite him frequently as a guy who had some unpleasant sides to him, but was a great commander. But Washington actually has the capacity to learn, and he does, and he amends his behavior, right?
I think he does. I think that's true. And he recognizes that, first of all, he's a Virginian commanding a largely New England army. This is the first effort to put together a national institution. He sees that. He knows how important it is. He knows that Congress has given him authority, and they're a little skeptical of it, and they're a little skeptical of him.
The book is called The British Are Coming. It is the first of three volumes by Pulitzer Prize winner Rick Atkinson. Mr. Atkinson, it's a pleasure. You're welcome back anytime, and especially for volumes two and three.
Thank you so much, Lars. I enjoyed talking to you.
It is a pleasure to have you on. We'll be back in a moment. You've got the Lars Larson Show.